I have a confession. I fell in love with coffee many years ago and have never looked back. Coffee and I share a special relationship. I love the taste and the morning ritual, the focus it delivers, and the general good mood it consistently provides. I also like to tinker with a host of different supplements to enhance my state of mind and my ability to feel my best. Everyday Dose has made this easier by putting some of the most useful ingredients into one product. Everyday Dose is coffee plus benefits. They combine high-quality coffee with the powerful ingredients like lion's mane and chaga, collagen protein, and nootropics to fuel your brain, boost focus, and give you clean, sustained energy all day long. It tastes just like coffee without the downside. No crash, no jitters, just clean, sustained energy. Right now, for Black Friday, get 61% off your first Coffee Plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/mindful or use code MINDFUL at checkout. Ever feel like your energy, focus, and recovery could use some extra support? Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly without any added fillers. When I was in the middle of what seemed to be a personal health crisis, Quiksilver Scientific was one of the brands I could always trust to get an effective, high-quality product. I remember using some of their liposomal nutrients and detoxification supplements. Every formula is designed with advanced liposomal delivery that wraps nutrients in tiny spheres your body recognizes, helping them absorb quickly so you get more from every dose. They have clean formulations, non-GMO, no unnecessary fillers, and they're allergen tested. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/mindfulmovement. That's tryqs.com/mindfulmovement. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
As adults, the anxiously attached individual deeply fears abandonment. And their way of dealing with this is to cling in relationships. They'll often present as needy, very anxious, sometimes very self-abandoning. You know, they'll say yes to things that they're not okay with. They won't share their own boundaries or their own truth in the name of people-pleasing and not losing somebody, which actually creates a tremendous amount of dysfunction in relationships, because the more we self-abandon and we don't feel understood and connected in partnership, the more likely we are to resent somebody. But also, you'll see as a rule here that anxiously attached individuals, they, you know, go through relationships always trying to hold on so tightly that they often lose people out of that.
Thais Gibson, thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm grateful to be here.
I was pumped to see that you guys reached out, because I've actually for a while wanted to get someone on to learn about attachment styles, like more generally. I hear them referenced a lot and I don't have a very deep understanding. And my instinct is to get like the 101 introduction, but there's also part of me that is just really selfish. And I just recently, like very recently, had like a challenging time with my wife, which is like the most important relationship and person in my life. And it's got me like thinking even more about these things. And she's like, much more like evolved and educated on psychology and behavior, you know, human behavior. So she's always analyzing these things, and I'm always like lagging behind and trying to learn and fumble through things more. There's things I'm good at, and then that's like not my niche really. But so this morning I was like binging. You have so much content. You are the co-founder of the Personal Development School, the host of the Thais Gibson podcast, but your YouTube channel is just a immense like resource of content. And I spent the morning trying in one part of mind just to prepare for this, to chat with you, but also just trying to pick up gems to like help me understand what I just went through like the last 2 days with a challenging time, and like how to, I don't know, dial in my relationship a little bit more. So one, I want to thank you. I know it's a lot of work to put out all that you have done. So I think it's awesome that you've done that. And you obviously have a lot of experience and wisdom to share. And so I'm excited to learn more.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And excited to dive in here.
Can we start with a really brief introduction of what attachment style is like referring to?
Yes. So your attachment style is essentially your relationship style. Sorry, I'm just getting over a bit of a cold. So you can think of it as being your relationship style. And the way I like to think of it is really the subconscious set of rules that you've been conditioned with about love and connection. So it will determine the way you expect your needs to be met, what those needs will be, how you operate with your boundaries, how you try to communicate, the level of vulnerability that you're comfortable with, and really the ways in which you'll give and receive love in relationships. And all of this comes from our originally childhood conditioning. Our attachment style usually forms between the ages of 0 to 2. But we also have to remember that our conditioning is not fixed. Neuroplasticity is a real thing. Anything we're exposed to through a lot of repetition and emotion will actually refire and wire neural pathways so we can get reconditioned. So our attachment style, the original body of work was born out of Cambridge University with John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth. And they talked about how there are 4 major attachment styles. And I can get into each of them and how they form. But this body of work was a little bit incomplete. It was like, if you have an attachment style, here it is. But it didn't talk about the fact that, hey, we have conditioning, we can recondition. If we have a series of attachment experiences in childhood that are creating, you know, maladaptive behavioral patterns, unhealthy, you know, relationship patterns, we can change that. You know, we're not born with our attachment style, it gets conditioned into us. We can actually rewire it. So there's hope for anybody who finds themselves in any of these 4 attachment styles and feels a little distressed about it. It doesn't have to be something that's like a label that you're stuck with for the rest of your life. So the first attachment style is the securely attached individual. Original research shows this is about 50% of the population, although it does seem to be on the downtrend the last 20 years or so. Securely attached people, one of the foundational cornerstones in how they build relationships is that they tend to get a lot of what we call approach-oriented behaviors. And this sounds like a small thing when you play it out, but it has big consequences. When a child is growing up in their home, they essentially get a lot of attunement. So a parent notices when they're distressed and they approach them. They try to soothe them. They try to see what's stressing them out. They try to make sure that that child feels supported. And that one behavior creates a huge positive impact. Now, there's other things that play into it, of course, but this is a huge cornerstone of this. And what this actually creates is a child going, okay, number one, it's safe to express my emotions. Number two, it's safe to rely on people. Number three, I'm still loved and given love and attention, even if I'm emotional, even if I'm having a bad day. So I'm worthy of love for who I am, not what I do. And it's safe to trust people to be there for me, to rely on them. And so this individual grows up and they have a lot healthier of modeling for relationships. They feel like it's comfortable to let people in, to be vulnerable, to communicate openly. They feel comfortable sharing their truth with people and their needs. They've learned healthy boundaries in their childhood. So they have statistically healthier relationships. And this is reported very clearly by showing that securely attached individuals don't just have the longest lasting relationships. They also report being the most fulfilled in those long-lasting relationships. And I think that's an important distinctive quality is that you can have long-lasting relationships, but trust me, as somebody who worked with many couples as a counselor and coach and was in private practice for many years, you can have a lot of people who stay together, but they're definitely not happy. And so I'm not sure I would call some of those situations successes until they actually do the work. So securely attached people just have healthier, longer lasting, better quality of relationships. And that's our first attachment style. Then we have 3 insecurely attached ones. Should we get into those?
Can I ask one question about that first one first? Do you mind?
Of course. That's what I was asking you.
So when you mention like even kids develop the ability when they have that approach-oriented process from their caregivers, like I assume primarily their parents, that they develop boundaries. Like how does a 5-year-old, like what's an example of like what a boundary for a 5-year-old looks like?
So it's things where parents are able to actually honor the child's truth. So let's say this child, as they're going through the conditioning process in childhood, number one, if your emotions are attuned to, we tend to treat our own emotions the way that our caregivers treat them, right? So people who are not given emotional attunement as adults, they don't attune to their own emotions at all, right? They're out of the loop with their own emotions. So what we'll see is your emotions actually, number one, give you feedback about where your boundaries are. Okay. So if your emotions are attuned to, then you know what's going on inside of you. And then if your emotions are honored, you're like, oh, I can honor my emotions. If something feels uncomfortable for me, I can say no, or I can pull away, or I can do these things that allow me to really have access to my truth. Okay. So that's number one. But number two, parents of securely attached kids, and this is another part that plays in here, they try to honor a child's boundaries and needs. And you'll see this in communication. So let's say a child is saying, you know, I want to eat candy, and it's 9 p.m. and the child's 5 years old and they should be going to sleep. And, you know, a parent who is not showing up in a very secure way with that child might just shame the kid, get angry. No, it's your bedtime. Stop asking. Get into bed right now before I count to three, right? We might have this sort of behavior that diminishes the child's emotions and emotional experience and also boundaries or needs. A parent who's more secure, they'll usually operate by doing something like this. They'll say, honey, I know you love candy. I know you want to eat candy. I understand. But it's 9 p.m. If you eat the candy, you're going to have a stomach ache. You're not going to sleep well. So how about this? We're going to go to sleep. And if you go to bed soon, then tomorrow after dinner, you can have a little bit of your favorite candy as long as you've eaten the proper dinner first. So what they're doing is they're actually honoring indirectly this boundary for the child or need for the child, which often goes hand in hand, by validating it first, by saying, I hear you, right? I know you want candy. I know that you love your candy. They're not just dismissing it in full. They're actually honoring that that's the child's experience. And then they're negotiating. They're saying, hey, let's go to bed. Let's do these things. But then we can always do this later on. And so even if they lead with that, it's teaching a child that it's okay to express myself. It's okay to express my needs, my likes, my dislikes. And all of these things play a really crucial role into how the child then learns to develop a healthy sense of boundaries going into future life and adult.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so let's move on to the other three. So secure attachment is the one. What's
yes.
the next?
So number two, and we can sort of imagine in a way that these attachment styles exist along a continuum. So number two, at one end of the continuum is the anxious attachment style. So anxious attachment styles, they grew up in a household where there's generally a lot of inconsistency. And you can think of the roots here as being real or perceived abandonment. Okay, real abandonment is the obvious. Parents divorce, the child doesn't see one of their parents very frequently, maybe a more traumatic thing, a parent passes away from a health crisis or an accident. These things are going to create these deep abandonment wounds. But what's really interesting about when you study the neuroscience of trauma is small t trauma, if it happens repeatedly enough, actually has a very similar impact on the brain and how we perceive ourselves and our environments later on as a singular big T trauma event. So if you have children who grew up with what we call perceived abandonment, if you see children who are constantly having parents who are there and then pulling away, there and then pulling away, maybe because they're very loving parents, but they work a lot. They have huge work demands. The kids are always left with the grandparents. And, you know, then over time, the child keeps going, okay, there's love, but it's taken away. Are they coming back? What's going on? And because of this, the repetition and emotion is actually firing these neural networks over time to create this deep-rooted fear of abandonment. Like, are they going to be here? Are they going to be present? Are they traveling again? Why do they keep leaving me? And so if that's happening consistently throughout a person's childhood, then you're going to see that that still has a similar impact to a more dramatic loss. And so anxiously attached children grow up constantly fearing abandonment, and they adapt to this fear of abandonment by trying to people please, by trying to maintain proximity, by trying to get closer to somebody over and over again. And they're always trying to cling on. And as a result, as adults, they usually have adapted to their childhood by being very friendly and charming and charismatic. They really garnered their people skills because they're trying to level those things to create connection with people because they deeply, deeply value connection with people. But they do it so much that essentially the primary casualty becomes the relationship they have to themselves. So when they're so externally focused, so focused on people pleasing, so, you know, needing to self-soothe almost exclusively through others, you know, they go through a hard time, they're calling everybody that they can talk to first. They never sit with it and process it themselves. And so because of this, we'll see a couple of things happen. As adults, the anxiously attached individual deeply fears abandonment. And their way of dealing with this is to cling in relationships. They'll often present as needy, very anxious, sometimes very self-abandoning. You know, they'll say yes to things that they're not okay with. They won't share their own boundaries or their own truth in the name of people pleasing and not losing somebody, which actually creates a tremendous amount of dysfunction in relationships, because the more we self-abandon and we don't feel understood and connected in partnership, the more likely we are to resent somebody. But also you'll see as a rule here that anxiously attached individuals, they, you know, go through relationships always trying to hold on so tightly that they often lose people out of that, because they're expecting everybody to want to spend as much time as they do in relationships, or as much, you know, intimacy and closeness all the time. And sometimes people are a little more independent, or sometimes people have different needs. And so they'll put so much pressure and emphasis on their relationship. It's almost like trying to hold on to sand. It sort of slips through your fingers. And so unfortunately, a lot of anxiously attached individuals struggle in relationships as adults and find that they constantly are trying so hard to love and to give all of themselves and to make a relationship work. And they keep hitting the same roadblocks where they feel disconnected, or they are left by people, or they jump into relationships with emotionally unavailable people because that feels safe and familiar. And so that's sort of some of the manifestations of the anxious.
Interesting. Yeah, I would raise my hand as one of those, or at least came out of the starting gate with a lot of that, probably, you know, around my parents splitting up when I was really young. But yeah. I think I have done like a lot of rewiring, as you say, over the years from all, you know, self-development, whatever. But it's interesting, like even in this recent episode where my wife and I had a little, challenging conversation, I guess. Like there was when she finally got to find her voice and express herself really well, like, my brain started to default to, and I thought, like, if you asked me 3 days ago, we're in the best place we've ever been. And I still believe that. Like, this is just a learning experience. Not like, oh, we're on the fucking ropes now, whatever. But it's like, I was observing myself, like, oh, she's going to find out this. She's going to realize I'm this. Like, she's going to leave me. Like this fear of abandonment. And I'm 48. You know, and I think this stuff started when I was like 4.
Yeah, 100%. And to your point, that's how it works, right? Because our subconscious mind stores everything. It's the warehouse of all of our beliefs and our thoughts and our emotional patterns or behavioral patterns. And unless we actively go in and recondition or rewire these very specific things, as soon as there's a catalyst for them in our external world, we jump to the same old conclusions. It's part of, you know, our identity. People often say, like, how does trauma affect you for so many years, whether it's small T trauma or big T trauma? Well, it's because it's carried with you at a subconscious level the whole time. And so, you know, it's just waiting to pop back out. It might be dormant for a while, but until we have these challenges or experiences, that's often what's going to take shape. So that's so interesting. And were you able to navigate the situation okay?
Well, it's funny. So 2 nights ago, we had a discussion and she was getting really heated. And I'm like always trying to help, but I'm not, my delivery has a lot to improve on. So my intention is always good. And I know that she knows my intention is good. But I think because of our styles being different, like I'm not an expert at delivering in a way that's received the best for her given style, I guess.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm like, and I'm trying to stay super calm. And I'm like, why are you getting so upset at this? And it was an issue. Like, we have some local businesses, and there was like an issue with one of the businesses that was really kind of triggering her. And I'm asking from a place that's like, because I care and I want to help. And I'm asking her, like, no, like, why do you think you're getting so upset? Like, what is the root in you?
What's going on here? Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
What's going on for you that this is triggering you so much? But that's heard very differently from her. Yeah. It's heard as like an attack on her emotions. Like, I'm not seeing and acknowledging
her
emotions.
Should calm down. Yeah. And it's, even though that's not your relationship to it at all. Yeah.
And I'm better at this than I used to be, but like, I still suck at it, obviously. So,
no.
So then last night she was able to, like, she had time to process and she like talked about it. And, you know, like for her, that feels very unsafe to her. I think when I'm like, questioning her, and cause it feels like she's under attack.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And she gives me an example of how I could have said it. And she's right. She's always right about stuff. But like in the moment, I don't have the skill set so dialed in. Like, I'm not good at it enough where in the moment I could pull the perfect arrow out of the quiver and like use that tool perfectly, like the phrasing and the tone or whatever.
If you're ever not sure about something, the best way to go is to say, hey, I really hear that you're hurt right now, or I really hear this is an uncomfortable thing for you, to validate somebody's emotions first and then say, but I want to understand it more. What do you think the root actually is? Like, if you just ask it that way and you validate emotions first and then you ask about the root, it doesn't really matter what the situation is or how it's playing out. If you ever don't know where to go with something, it's what we call bridge questions in couples relationships, where when somebody's on the spot and we don't have the best, you know, approach, we don't know how to do something in the moment all the time, because sometimes we're met with these foreign situations that we never would have expected. And we're like, and sometimes I think it's really human and it's really normal to be like, I don't know what to say. What's the right thing to say here? Like, or sometimes to even be scared that we'll say the wrong thing and that can make us clam up even more, or, you know, to not even recognize that that could be taken the wrong way. Right. Cause your intention and your relationship to it is so good. And it's actually a really good question. It's like, what's the root? We're asking the right thing. I can see how the phrasing could be misconstrued. Right. And so if you're ever just not sure, that's the easiest way to go, is just to use a bridge statement, and they really open up dialogue and open up conversation very quickly. And it gets us out of those places where we get stuck. Cause people tend to go toe to toe on things, and they ask one thing and the other person gets frustrated, and then you feel frustrated, the person's misunderstanding you. And then, you know, so those are the things that break us out of those vicious cycles that we can get locked into.
Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, we used to do this a lot. Like, we've been together 22 and a half-ish years, or married that long. So, like, our whole adult lives, like, we were kids when we got together. And so we sucked at it for a long time. So, like, these things are fewer and far between, you know, might be 2-3 times a year now, but they still happen. And, like, the idea of a bridge question, that's perfect. I want, like, how does someone get, like, the things that I'm good at in life, like, I don't need to think about what should I say here. Like, I work in a gym. I have a lot of experience in a gym environment. Like, if I see a movement pattern that's like showing some kind of compensation or whatever, like, I just see it. Like, I don't have to like go to my database of list of, like, it just happens. I guess what I want to get better at is having the 2 or 3 optional sentences to pull to where I don't, like, if it's in the moment and I have to be able to pull out one of these instantly, how do I train myself to go to that?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And we'll come back to in a minute, and we'll talk about like the other attachment styles and when your wife might be too. But because sometimes the attachment interaction plays a role in terms of what each person really needs. So usually each attachment style has specific needs. Gotcha. And that's always a good thing to equip yourself with. You can think of that as being like the roadmap to navigating things in relationships as well, is to know A, your own needs in conflict, but B, your partner's needs in conflict. And honestly, knowing them top of mind. But what I would say is, you know, from the perspective of how do you bring out these things in real time, the best thing to do is to have a couple of frameworks that you honestly memorize. I mean, if I were to say, okay, you're great and you notice things naturally in the gym and compensation things that are happening with people's movement, you probably, if I said, okay, well, how many hours did you spend doing that before, you know, before you actually, it was second nature, you probably studied it and trained and, you know, did all this research for years. And that's why it comes naturally. And I think that it's very, again, like human and normal to be in a position where nobody's supposed to know this stuff off the top of your head. You're not supposed to just have it figured out in real time, because we don't learn these things, right? And we're not mind readers. So what I like to do is when there's a couple things. I would say, number one, know your bridge statements. Number two, just have a couple of bridge statements that you memorize, that you keep at the back of your mind. And to know that when somebody's really upset, one of the best things to do is to lead with vulnerability. So to say, and to validate somebody's emotion. So if you can say, hey, I see that you're upset. I really care. I don't know what's going on. I feel confused. You know, I don't have all the answers. Usually those are these pattern disruptors that when we're in the heat of the moment and somebody just inserts validating your feelings and then just even speaking vulnerably about what's going on for them. Like, I want to help you. I don't want to be in conflict with you. I don't want to fight right now, but I don't know what's going on. I'm confused too. Those are the things that when we're just truly validating somebody else's emotions and then truly being vulnerable, they really disrupt conflict and move us way more into a productive territory. I used to sit with couples and when they would get heated, and trust me, I worked with some very heated couples in the past, I would just get them to do that. I would say, hold on, pause the conversation. Just say what's actually coming up for you. Do you see why your partner is feeling the way that they're feeling? Or can you at least empathize with what they're feeling and care that they're hurting right now? And what's going on for you? And right away, you would see the conflict in the conversation just completely evolve and go in a different direction. So it's a great thing to practice there. But then when we're actually looking at conflict resolution frameworks, there's a few, but the one I always would keep top of mind is feeling need. So this idea that what we need is for each person to validate each other's feelings and each person to express what they need to feel resolved. And once both parties do that in a conflict, like somebody's able to say, yeah, I'm feeling hurt because ABC and I need XYZ. And then their partner can be like, okay, I see that you're hurt and I care that you're hurt about ABC. And, you know, let's talk about XYZ. And when they can do that, that tempers one person and then we flip it around. So then, you know, the other person gets to flip it around and go, okay, well, can I express what I'm feeling, what I need now? Because when there's a conflict, even if one person had the issue to start off with that they brought into the relationship discussion, the other person, if there's a conflict, still feels hurt, at least by the nature of the conflict or the disagreement or the arguing that's taking place. So, and it's something I practice if I ever have a challenge in my own marriage, or if I ever have a challenge with a family member or something, I'll be like, okay, have we each expressed our feelings? Have they been validated? Have we each expressed our needs? And as long as you do that, it's actually really hard to stay in a conflict that's unresolved. And so that's why it's meaningful to kind of know the needs of the different attachment styles too. It gives you some extra information if you really wanted to get good. And we can get into some of that. But to summarize, bridge statements. If you're ever really stuck and can't even think of one, just think of like, hey, I just need to make my partner feel heard. I need to say, I see you. I hear that you're upset. I care. And I'm also scared or confused right now, you know, and really having that vulnerability. And then if you can and you wanted to get really practiced at it, you can almost have a mental checklist. Did we each express what we're feeling and validate each other's? And did we each express our need and come up with a strategy to meet each other? So the feeling need for each person. And I think if you just nail down those three things and practice them every time, and even like you could always meditate and visualize yourself moving through those things and past conflict, like, okay, what would I have done 3 months ago when we had an argument? Okay, I would have said it this way and done that. You know, if we practice it, it will get familiar and then it will eventually become second nature for sure.
That's interesting. Thais, I'm going to start regular fights now so I could practice these bridge statements. I'm kidding. It's funny because like lately, cognitively, I've been thinking like, what are her needs and trying to be more in tune with them. And I see that I think she needs more from me in that regard. And I never think about, at least within the context of like a conflict, what my need is to like feel resolved. Like I don't inherently feel like I have one, but I must.
Yeah. It's so interesting because you think you're anxiously attached. I still think there's a chance that maybe you're the fearful avoidant or you were growing up. So I want to, we'll come into that because that'll determine your needs, but I'll tell you the needs of the anxious attachment. And then we can go through the needs of each person. The anxious attachment, especially in conflict, they're always they feel the most resolved when they get reassurance that somebody's not going anywhere and when they get certainty. So they're looking for like, they feel solved in a conflict for the most part. If somebody says, hey, I care about you. I'm not going anywhere. I still love you. We're going to make it through this. These are the things that we're going to do. And if they have a sense of like certainty or structure and they have reassurance, generally like the conflict's over for them. Like they're not carrying it after that. But in general, anxiously attached individuals in their relationships to feel fulfilled, they validation, reassurance in general. They need to feel like wanted and like they're a priority. They want
that's it. Wanted. Like I feel like, I think there's a physical thing that I need, and maybe this is just dysfunctional, but this is who I am. Or maybe it's just like the part of the man inside me, but like I want to feel wanted physically. And to me, that's like very resolving. Like,
yeah.
And it could be anywhere from, I don't know, like a long hug to like, let's rip each other's clothes off or like whatever it is. But And maybe that, like, I don't know if that's healthy or not. I try not to judge myself.
That is completely healthy. That is so normal. Yeah, that's, there's
nothing wrong with that. Validating my feelings.
No, but I think that people fall into this trap of, like, trying to think that their needs should be different than they are. And, like, that's a very common, very human need. That's, like, usually about 25% of the population is just rooted in that as being a something that resolves. Wanting to feel wanted, wanting to have physical affection, physical touch, intimacy, things that make them feel like, okay, we've got this closeness. Obviously, physical touch is actually one of the five major love languages. So, like, that's very human. And that's not actually exclusive to men. That's very much not, like, non-gender specific at all. But it's funny because I find sometimes men, like, judge themselves for it. And it's like, okay, but I always feel my heart always goes out when I see people doing that. So, yeah, so wanted, and then some other, you know, ones that can be in there is they definitely want somebody to be, present with them, attuned to them. They want to feel at times that they're, you know, a priority in the relationship, like somebody's actually making an effort to, plan with them, things like that. So those are generally some of the really big needs, but definitely certainty is a big one as well. So knowing that we're good, knowing that we're okay, knowing that we're, you know, no one's going anywhere, we're going to stay together. Just having certainty around things can go a long way as well.
Yeah, that makes sense too for me, the certainty. Because, like, there's part of me, like I said, just like last night when she's, like, finally talking through everything and I'm, like, just listening to her. It's like there's part of me that is uncertain. Like, are we going to make it? I mean, I remember a long time ago, I don't know, we were maybe 10 years into marriage or something, where we were going through a rough time. And I remember asking her, like I always assumed we were great. Like, we were going to be together forever. And, like, I asked her something that, like, created an opening for her to answer that, like, that wasn't 100% absolute. And I was devastated. Like, the idea that this might not last forever. And, you know, I'm sure my parents, like, not only did my parents split up early, but for up until even, like, late teen years, for some reason, I thought they were going to get back together. So, like, periodically I would have, like, a realization where that wasn't happening. And it was like a re-injury. It was like a re-wounding.
Feeling it again.
Feeling it out again. Like, that, which is like, you know, just, I don't know, making that neural pathway, like, deeper and stronger that, you know, whatever comes off of that feeling of, whether it's abandonment or, like, not good enough for your dad to stick around or whatever, like, 100%. just was reinforced.
Yeah. And so the wounds, right? So each attachment cell, so this is according to integrated attachment theory, we developed a system where each attachment cell has specific needs. They each have specific wounds. And some of the wounds, the core fears are not just abandonment, they're abandonment, being alone, being disliked or rejected, especially by their partner, like feeling like the partner's not enjoying your company, enjoying your presence. That can be very, like, oh, you dislike me. Sometimes exclusion can be a big thing in other relationships, or if a partner goes, you know, away without you, kind of feeling a little left out or things like that. But then also, not good enough is a huge one. And feeling a sense of, like, emotional unsafety, which I think some people have a hard time naming, but it really shows up for people, a small degree of panic if they don't feel like that certainty is there. So those are the big wounds for the anxious attachment cell in particular as well. And it's interesting because I just heard you say one of them. I just heard you say, I'm not good enough that my dad was going to stick around. And it's like, it's so tragic, right? Because, you know, as an adult, I'm sure you know the child doesn't have any impact on whether the parents stay together. But you know, you just, as children personalize everything. And it's part of, like, stages of behavioral development. And so kids take that on so much. And to your point too, like, when there's this re-injury of it happening, that'll just deepen the neural networks more and more over time. So it's interesting, you know, once you're in a marriage for a couple decades, you've usually worked out a good bit of your attachment style, but you know, especially if you've learned to communicate through things. But I bet maybe, you know, much earlier in the marriage, you even felt some of those anxious attachment patterns even more strongly until
a lot of marriages, I don't think they work them out. I don't think they ever shine light on it. I mean, a lot of marriages don't work out. And that's part of why.
One of the most significant reasons. Like, I truly believe, and it's interesting because you actually see the divorce rate and the stats around secure attachment go hand in hand. So 50% of people statistically are generally securely attached, and 50% of marriages statistically end in divorce. And so I think that that's one of the number one determinants, period. Probably the number one is whether or not you have people who are able to at least get to a place of being rooted in some degree of secure behavior. So, and to your point, you know, once you're in 20 years of marriage, more like you, where, you know, you have these little ruptures every 3 months, 4 months, you know, a couple times a year, maybe, and you work through them and you resolve them. Like, there's a foundation of secure attachment in there, but absolutely, you can see people who are literally just fighting all the time, bickering, very unhappy, and they're usually not securely attached at all and really haven't learned any communication tools yet. So absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting. And the fact that I always, like, lag my wife in the learning of these tools, because she's more driven to learn about this stuff. So it's like there is some of that left behind and almost abandonment. Like, if she grow, like, she gave me this idea, and I don't know where she got it from. And I've mentioned it on the podcast a few times, but I think it's great. Like, your life is like a puzzle piece, and you have all these people or activities, whatever, all these relationships that fit in the puzzle piece. And as your puzzle piece, as you grow, you need some, like, parallel or adjacent growth of the other pieces so that they still fit. So, and a lot of that, so, like, one of our big, I don't know, ruptures or waves of, like, challenge years ago, you know, there was a lot of that. Like, she was ahead of me in, like, the personal growth thing. So she's learning all this stuff and I'm lagging, and that created, like a pressure, like a left behind pressure. And I think right now, like, she's actually in the middle of a relationship coaching course now. So she's, like, back submerged in education and learning all these different ways to understand herself more. And of course, our relationship. So it gets her, like, analyzing and thinking, which part of me is like, that's one of my questions today. Like, part of me, I don't want to say it worries, like, but there's part of me that, like, considers the price or potential price of, like, learning all this stuff, because you, like, start to look at the world through this lens. Like, I told you, I'm a movement guy. I can't turn it off. If I see someone, like, running down the street and their right foot's, like, turned out 7 degrees or whatever, like, I'm, like, fixated. Like, I don't know how to turn that analysis off, you know? Like, I want to pull them over and be like, let me help you. So I wonder, like, does it promote every encounter in a relationship to be, like, under a microscope where you're analyzing, well, you said this because of this. And it's like, does that have the potential to suck the passion or instantaneous, like some of the romance out of it, when it's like, you know, so much that you're going to be thinking about?
So funny, I did a training last night, and I want to make sure at some point we circle to the other attachment styles too, because I know, just so you see what your wife might be, or what, you know, because that'll be interesting. But somebody asked, I was doing a training last night, I actually teach a certification program, and somebody asked me this, because they're learning, and they're learning a lot. And they were like, am I going to never be able to unsee all these things? Like, what's going to happen? And I said, and it was such a great question. It just leapfrogs off of, like, what you're bringing up. You won't unsee it, like the movement, right? You'll notice things, but you'll learn what to take on and what not to. So for example, you know, I've been with my husband for a little over a decade, and, like, for sure, I know a lot about, like, he's like a computer scientist. Like, he's, you know, and, like, there's things that, like, I'll just notice or see in people, but I've done a really good job of making sure I'm not trying to ever play therapist. Like, my husband's my husband. And, like, I go to him and I chat with him, and I might have more intricacies about myself to bring to the table. I might say, hey, I'm feeling like this, and maybe it connects to this thing, and, you know, and I'll bring it up. And I would say, if you just learn what to do with it properly, if you learn the boundaries properly, and also what you're taking on and not taking on, like, to your point, there's been so many encounters I've had with people over the years, sitting on an airplane or, you know, sitting at a park bench or whatever it might be, and somebody says something, you just know what's underneath that. And, you know, there's elements to that, but not all of it's yours, right? And I think that the wisdom of taking that information and then applying it is it's not a bad thing. I think it's almost exclusively good, as long as your boundaries are good. And as long as you know that you're not there to play therapist to your closest relationships, you're there to have, like, a human to human interaction. And so where I see it get sour or suck the life out of things is when somebody starts, you know, mothering or fathering their spouse, right? If it were to be your wife and she's suddenly trying to like psychoanalyze you all the time and bring you back into things and make you work through things. And she's playing that role too frequently instead of just like using her skills to hash things out better if there's a conflict, then that's not good. That'll suck the intimacy out of things, or vice versa. If you were to do that with her and you learn all these skills, like that's not helpful, right? That ends up feeling like there's a strange mothering, fathering, you know, parenting dynamic going on. If instead both people come to the table and are like, hey, we have to hash this out. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about this. And both people share and both people come to the table, then you're growing together instead of growing apart. I'm a big believer that when we have a conflict, there were pre-existing invisible walls between yourself and that person. And conflict was the climatic part where we realized there were invisible walls. We realized there was something wrong and now we break them down. And either you do conflict right and now we actually got closer because of it and broke those walls down, or we didn't do conflict right and we built more of them. And so, you know, I actually think it's a really great thing to have proper tools and skills. I think it can only like help things going forward in the future. But then I guess the other part too is like your boundaries, right? If you were to stop everybody when you see them running and their foot turns 7 degrees, you know, you're going to exhaust yourself, right? You're going to be like, you know, all day you're going to be on doing stuff. And so, you know, knowing when to settle into, you know, sometimes I go to family events and I'll hear people say things and or make comments and I'm like, oh, I know what's under that one, or, you know, I'll to each other, you know, perhaps, you know, an aunt and uncle or, you know, things like that. And you see things and you're going, oh, okay, you know, and you know, but you're not gonna take it on, you know, that's theirs to sort out. And so having good boundaries is really important too.
Yeah, that makes sense. And also it's kind of a fine line because I think about all the times that, and maybe, you know, maybe there is, I don't know if this is dysfunctional or part of some codependency or whatever. There've been many times where one of us has helped the other,
yeah,
you know, through advice, which exactly could be mothering or fathering. I mean, we both as kids had parents that we probably had needs from them and didn't get. And you look for ways to get those things. And some of those come in the form of like me helping her get regrounded if she kind of gets off track with stuff, or her, because of her like expertise and understanding, helping me through an issue I have with like a family member where, like, I don't know, where she helps me see a different way to approach an interaction with like a sister I don't get along with or something, where it can be kind of mothering in a way. So like where, like, that could be a fine line of therapizing or whatever your partner, as opposed to just growing together, as you say, or supporting them.
Yeah, I think that that's healthy. So advice, leaning on each other, opening up, talking through things. I mean, those are all like the gold standard of what we should expect in relationships. Where it moves into mothering and fathering is A, one person's taking on the full emotional responsibility. So let's pretend it's you and your wife, and let's pretend that your wife is constantly forcing you to talk about your feelings when you're not, gotcha, you know, trying to. Constantly sitting down saying, okay, but your feelings come from this, and do you see it, and psychoanalyzing you and taking that all on. And then if you're resistant to doing the work or having those conversations and you're not stepping up to have them, right, there's not this equal, hey, let's talk about these things together, let's create a breakthrough together, let's grow through this together. It's like somebody trying to force it out of you, drag you through the experience. And then if it's only one person doing that and it's not a collaborative experience, there's not the support that person, that your wife, would then receive from you. And I mean, you can clearly see in just how you communicate your dynamics that's not the case at all. And leaning on each other is really good, but it's when one person's forcing it, one person's taking, I always say there's, you know, each person in a relationship is 100% responsible for their 50% of the relationship. And if one person's taking on both people's 50%, we have codependency. If one person's forcing somebody to talk about things they don't want to talk about, if somebody's constantly psychoanalyzing you and sitting you down to try to make it sure that you're doing the same, I mean, that becomes this mothering and fathering dynamic rather than like mutual advice giving, showing up to talk about hard things, leaning on each other, which are all very healthy parts of a relationship.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. That's well said. I agree. And you I couldn't articulate it as well as you just did. That's nice. So that's two. So you went over secure, you went over anxious.
Yeah.
What's
and then we have the opposite. So okay. The opposite really of the anxious, it's sort of the other end of the continuum, is the dismissive avoidant. So the dismissive avoidant, they grow up with childhood emotional neglect. And this can be very overt, very obvious, where it's like food's not on the table, parents are never around. But the vast majority of the time, it's not that at all. The vast majority of the time, it's more covert emotional neglect. It's food is on the table. You know, there's structure in the home. Kids are at school on time. You know, they have after school activities. But when the dismissive, avoidant child is growing up and trying to express emotion or yearning for attunement, the parents are not attuned. And when parents are not attuned, and even if they express small amounts of irritation, frustration, dismissal, denial of the child's emotions, a child learns, okay, my emotions are unwanted. They're not safe to express. And me yearning to connect emotionally only results in rejection, really. They're getting this constant feedback that, nope, not here. Children should be seen and not heard, or don't be a crybaby, or stiff upper lip, or, you know, and if there's this constant feedback that your emotions are unwanted and not appropriate, then a child goes, okay, well, I guess I have to just dismiss and disconnect from this part of myself and just push my emotions deep down and not really attune to my own feelings because my feelings are not being attuned to. So they don't get that mirroring experience of learning self-attunement because, again, we tend to treat ourselves so much as a mirror due to how we were treated. But then on top of that, you get this active need to deny and repress your emotion as an adaptation to work in that environment. So if you never have that emotional feedback, that attunement, that emotional connection, it's like, well, it feels unsafe and painful to want that. And so, you know, let me just push it way down because I don't want to keep wanting something and then just feeling rejected or ashamed of myself that I do want it. And so dismissive avoidance, they grow up and they are very disconnected from their own emotions, number one. Number two, they fear vulnerability because they, you know, when they were vulnerable as kids, it didn't feel good for them. So they go to great lengths to avoid vulnerability, to avoid being deeply seen and known is something that sometimes they yearn for, but very much frightens them. And dismissive avoidance also get into a dynamic where they often fear commitment. They're like, I felt trapped in my childhood. This is their subconscious speaking, if it had a voice, right? It's like, I felt trapped in my childhood as a vulnerable kid wanting connection. Why would I want to enter into a long-term relationship where I would recreate those patterns and experiences? What if I get trapped again and I'm wanting something that's not there for me and I'm stuck here? And so, you know, they very much try to avoid those things or panic around those things. And their coping mechanism is almost opposite to the anxious. The anxious wants to keep maintaining proximity and getting closer. The dismissive avoidant, their coping mechanism is to minimize their attachment needs. So they will keep trying to create distance, even in relationships. Sometimes they'll flaw find in their partner to convince themselves they don't really need the partner. Yeah, these are the way, oh, these are the reasons it wouldn't work out anyways. Or look, these are the flaws, you know, and that's their way of actually self-protecting when they're feeling vulnerable.
There's some people that come to mind when I hear
Yeah, I bet. I think for everybody. and so they go to great lengths to create that emotional distance because it's actually their way of soothing themselves. And as adults, they actually really struggle to soothe through people. Again, sort of opposite to the anxious that you see almost exclusively soothe through people. Dismissive avoidance soothe through things. So they soothe through like their hobbies. Sometimes they're workaholics or sometimes they're like, you know, hobbyaholics where they're always, you know, spending hours and hours, you know, doing these hobbies that they're really obsessed with. Or, you know, they sometimes have more unhealthy soothing mechanisms, like what we call creature comforts. So they'll get really invested in, you know, things like binge watching television, binge playing video games, binge eating junk food, you know, these things that are there to kind of soothe them and to try to put them into alcohol, absolutely, drugs, substances. You'll see the whole gamut of things. Not that every dismissive avoidant uses substances unhealthily or alcohol, but just that a lot of people who do, it's because they're soothing through that because they have an avoidant mechanism in their attachment style. Again, not everybody, but they often do go hand in hand.
It's funny. There's someone in my life that I remember they ended a relationship and they were like, in an email, she used the wrong form of the word there. Like, and I'm like, come on.
No, I swear. You wouldn't believe how many stories I've heard like this over the years from dismissal points. And they ended the relationship and that was like the straw that broke the camel's back.
I mean, that was at least the excuse they had at the time. Yeah.
I've heard things so frequently like this. Like I've heard they double called me and that's it. I will never be double called. They called me twice back to back in a row. Like, obviously I'm not there if I didn't answer the first time. It's over. Or I had a client once who, I had a friend once as well, actually, this is even a better story, but They said, oh, she left her makeup out on the counter. And I just, she was messy. It wasn't, and it was like the hardest part, I think, for dismissive avoidance, honestly, is that they don't realize that these are solvable problems because they never got modeled how to solve conflict growing up. So they also flaw find because they're looking for the perfect partner because they think that like conflict is unsolvable, not consciously, but subconsciously. And what they don't realize is like, okay, if the person's messy, that's a solvable problem. Ask the person to leave their makeup somewhere else or you know, have the conversation, like hash it out with them. And sure, if messy is a non-negotiable for you and it's super important to you to have tidiness and you try to hash it out and they don't listen or they're rude or disrespectful and you're just dating them, okay, maybe that's something you don't want to proceed with if you're earlier into dating. But the vast majority of the time, these things that dismissive avoidance would end relationships over or say they end relationships over, usually what's actually happening is they're fearing vulnerability and that fear is rising. And then they find these small things to justify pushing away to soothe themselves. And so it seems like the small things are the straw that broke the camel's back, but there's a deeper subconscious story, right? But they'll, you know, it's like they'll say, oh, it's the makeup or it's the there or the way they texted or the double call or, you know, whatever it is. But really, it's their own internal relationship to vulnerability. And it's also that they don't know how to solve those things. You know, if those things bother them, they don't know how to say, hey, do you mind being a little more tidy when you're at my place? You know, my space is really important to me. And they don't know how to communicate very effectively. And so when you assume that something's an unsolvable problem, obviously, you're more likely to make it into a bigger thing than it is.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's so interesting. I mean, I assume there's like overlap and people come, like these all exist on some kind of spectrum and you have like a dominant thing. And obviously, I mean, you say you could shift over time with rewiring and practice. On that one, is there like a fear of intimacy too? Like,
oh,
like
yeah.
You wouldn't like, because yeah. That's.
Absolutely. Sorry. Finish your question. Go ahead.
I mean, and maybe that's tied to the, like the discomfort around being vulnerable or something.
Absolutely. So we have different pillars of relationships. So there's our romantic pillar, there's our physical or sexual pillar, there's our emotional pillar, and there's our intellectual pillar. And you'll actually see that different attachment styles generally trend towards different pillars. So it is common for anxious attachment styles to value more like the emotional and physical pillars because they're more vulnerable and they're seeking vulnerability and depth and closeness, right? So they want that, like, let's be close. Let's connect deeply and openly, you know, let's share things, let you know. And so they tend to trend more there. Dismissive avoidance are much more polarized towards the intellectual pillar. So a lot of dismissive avoidance, they like to share their philosophies, opinions, ideas, hobbies. They like to talk about things that they're up to, or they can be kind of quiet, but they don't have a lot of comfort in the vulnerability pieces. And there's a certain degree of vulnerability around intimacy and around, emotional connection. And so those pillars, they may create a little bit of space or distance around. You can see in certain cases that dismissive avoidance trend in the opposite direction. So sometimes in like early dating, dismissive avoidance will rely more on the physical connection pillar and be a little more like touchy-feely or sexual or intimate that way. But as soon as they actually feel like there's a vulnerable connection and they're really establishing depth with somebody, and like, oh my gosh, I have feelings. This person's actually making me feel vulnerable. You'll often see them then retreat and sort of pull back quite strongly. And a lot of it's just those core triggers that are coming up for them. And a lot of their triggers as a whole, they have fears around being seen as defective or shameful. So they don't like people to deeply see them. They have fears around being trapped in the wrong situation, being weak if they open up. These are their sort of core triggers and fears. They do have a trigger around being not good enough as well. So they do share in that with the anxious attachment style. But they also have a trigger around feeling helpless. A lot of dismissive avoidance feel like they're kind of in learned helplessness, especially with relationships where they might just not know how to solve something or speak about something. And they kind of go, well, why bother? And they just retreat. And it's really a deep learned helplessness that exists there. And so they kind of feel like, oh, maybe I'm incapable of doing relationships, or that's just not for me, or, you know, I'm just not good at things like that. And they sort of shut themselves. They're good at disqualifying themselves prematurely around things.
But do all these, like, you name all these things that are like negative things, essentially. Like, I don't want to say flaws, but like they're patterns that don't necessarily serve their greater good, but there's part of it that makes them that does serve them. Like there's something that's helping them survive. Right. So like in that case, why would a how is that What are they going to be good at as an adult because of this, like, I don't want to say maladaptive, but the manifestation of the patterns that they have or behaviors?
Yeah, 100%. This is a great question. So, and you're right. I do kind of share all the negative things first because I'm in the business of like rewiring them for people. So we like get it all out first and then we talk about how to rewire it and leverage neuroplasticity to change it. So it's a great point. But they do have superpowers. So anxious. So we'll go through anxious and dismissive and then we can talk about the fearful avoidant after. But anxious superpowers are they're very likable, very charming, very charismatic. They've strengthened their people skills. And so they're usually people who are very personable, open, great with other people, very friendly, make fast friends with people if they want to, do great in like people-oriented jobs or careers, good team players, very mindful and respectful and conscientious about people around them. And obviously conscientiousness is a personality trait associated with success a lot of the time. So, great traits over there. Dismissive avoidance, their superpowers are that they're extremely logical, extremely rational, extremely grounded. They're the people who often operate extremely well under pressure. They're very perseverant. They're good at going through hard things and buckling down, right? They're the people that you'll see be, you know, not always, but a lot of the times there's a correlation between, being more dismissive avoidant. And because you've kind of denied your emotional focus, you focus so much on your mind. And so a lot of them are extremely intelligent. They're sort of your, not always, but often your rocket scientists, your engineers, your computer scientists. You've got a lot of individuals who are in that space, and they're really good. They love cold, hard facts. They love to dissect problems. They're good problem solvers. So there's a lot of amazing benefits there too. And what's cool is that when people actually rewire and heal their attachment style, they retain like their personality traits that are the good ones, because you're not changing those or trying to rewire those, but then they get to drop their wounds and their triggers and they become a little more vulnerable and open. They strengthen their ability to communicate. So we can, you'll see when you change your attachment style, you won't just change your whole personality, but instead you'll be able to keep the strengths and then the things that were constantly triggering you or the fears that you had or the times that you would retreat or stonewall if you're dismissive avoidant or, push people away or flaw find. Instead, you have healthier approaches. You talk things out or you approach them in healthy ways. Or the times you would get really afraid if you're more anxious, you're like, no, like we've got this. You can be more grounded. And so you'll see there definitely can be some superpowers there.
Yeah, that's an optimistic way to contextualize it. I mean, like, it's like we all have strengths and we all have just room areas of like growth potential.
Yeah, and such.
All right, so that's three. So what's the fourth?
Fourth one. So the fourth one is the fearful avoidant. Sometimes you'll hear it referred to as the disorganized attachment style, which is probably a better name for it, honestly. So the fearful avoidant or disorganized, they grow up with chaos. So they're the individual sort of characterized by the most trauma, and more big T trauma, more consistent trauma. So you can think of this person as being the one who grows up in a household where there's either like just tremendous amounts of fighting and arguing and kind of explosive volatility in the household on a really regular basis. Or perhaps a parent has narcissistic personality disorder. And so there's a lot of lying or gaslighting or manipulating. Perhaps a parent or both parents are in active addiction, so struggling with substance use issues. The analogy I like to give that I think paints it the best is, let's say you have a parent who's an alcoholic, and let's say it's a single parent, maybe it's a single mom, and that parent, one day kids come home from school and mom's had a few drinks and she's in a good mood and she's sweet and the kids are feeling connected to mom, thank goodness. But then mom keeps drinking throughout the night and mom turns angry and sometimes cruel. Or sometimes mom's passed out and you're scared and you're like, what's happening? Is she alive? What's going on here? Or sometimes mom is, detoxing and she's in a really bad mood, having a really hard time and you don't know if she's okay. And it's like the overarching theme is that you never know what you're going to get. And so as a result of this, a child, just like the anxious attachment style learns to try to activate and stay closer, and the dismissive avoidant learns to deactivate and create distance to cope, fearful avoidance or disorganized attachment styles, they learn to be extremely hypervigilant. They're always trying to think three steps ahead, predict the future, look at everything that could go wrong. They are extremely attuned to people. I would call fearful avoidance the human lie detectors as a joke, because they are literally, they notice any and every little thing. And what's really interesting is if you get these really polarizing experiences where there's chaos, Usually within the chaos are sometimes really good moments. Even if you think of a parent being a narcissist, sometimes that parent love bombs and is so loving and so there if you are appeasing them. And other times the parent is the opposite. And so what happens is you get this fearful avoidant individual and they get conditioned to feel opposing things about the same thing. So love and connection. Love and connection can be, on one side, a really beautiful thing that I yearn for. I want that closeness. I fear abandonment. I want to be closer and connected. And I want that depth and that intimacy in different ways. And on the other hand, I'm really scared when you get really close and I need you to stay back. You're a little too close now and you could really hurt me. And so fearful of when do a lot of this come here, get closer. Oh, you're close. Get back, stay away. And they pinball back and forth all the time between wanting love and being scared of it. And so, they have this really warm side. They're very, present and generous and open and very deep. They're not superficial at all. They want to go to the roots of everything. But on the flip side, when people do get close, they feel threatened a lot of the time. And sometimes they can be a little bit more volatile or explosive in arguments. They carry a little more hurt. Their nervous systems are a little more dysregulated. And they are always trying to think and prepare for the future. 5 steps ahead, what could come next, whether it's the future of what could happen in a relationship, future of what could happen in a friendship and at work. And it makes them... And, to your point, they have superpowers. They're so good at attuning to people. They know people deeply. They're great at getting other people to be vulnerable and pulling information out of them. They're not the best at then sharing that information back vulnerably. They will open up about things, but things they truly feel vulnerable about, they tend to keep quite close to their chest. So they could share a childhood experience, but if there's something they're currently going through that they feel a little ashamed about, they're not going to be telling you that one. So there's this sort of duality to them. And their big fears, their big wounds are, they also fear abandonment because they have that anxious side to them in a sense. They're sort of in the middle of the continuum in a way, but they also fear being trapped in the wrong relationship. And they have a deeper sense of unworthiness because usually they got love in their childhood when they were caretaking for people. So maybe they got love when they were putting their alcoholic parent to bed who was sleeping on the floor and giving them some water. And so that's when they got connection. So a lot of their depth feels like their worth depends on their ability to be there for others and show up. And so there's this deep sense of loneliness and sadness in that, because if you're going through life thinking that love is an earned thing and you're always trying to overgive and underreceive and not take too much and be more and do more to win approval so that you can then just be lovable, there's a painful element to that for them. And so they can make amazing partners because they're very giving, very generous, very present, very deep, see everything, but they can handle conflict probably exceptionally poorly, you could say. I don't want to be too harsh to them. I was a fearful avoidant. That was my attachment. That's how I got into this work. So I'm allowed to say things like that. But you'll see that there can be a really poor ability to handle conflict a lot of the time because it runs so deep. There's much deeper roots. But again, that's why it's so important to heal those things, because fearful avoidants, when you go into relationships, they feel like there's a bittersweetness even to love. It's like, oh, the more I love or care about somebody, the more they can hurt me. And so even falling in love for a fearful avoidant is kind of this disruptive experience where they feel great about the person and can love the person. But then there's a lot of, passing thoughts and fears around, how much will this person hurt me now? Oh my gosh, I feel really vulnerable to them and things are going to get, I'm going to be really hurt one day. And they really struggle to trust themselves and they really struggle to trust other people and to trust the future. So those are some of the big themes there for sure.
I believe it's basically impossible for parents not to screw up their kids. It's like, because they all those parents also have their own attachment styles. Like, it's just a continuation. Let me ask you a common thing that I think I see parents do. Setting like expectations that might be just high or just like totally unrelated to what the child cares about, whether it's, grades, doing enough activities, doing better at their sport, like no matter how well they do, how can you do one step better? What's that likely to lead to for the child?
Yeah, this is such a good question. I know where you're going with this too. You're like, how do you try to encourage these things, but also not end up hurting the child in the process? So here's the biggest difference. So having healthy expectations, setting goals for your kids, trying to push them to grow, those are healthy things. But it are the only or vast majority of the times that a child receives love rooted in that. So the child receives love when they get the goal, they get the good grade, or when they get the goal, score the goal, or when they take care of the parent or fix a problem. And that's almost exclusively when they get love. Or is there a loving household? And there's a stability of love and connection. There's care. I always say, like, a great way to create securely attached kids is to give them love for no reason. If the child's coloring in the corner, they're not doing anything that's necessarily productive for society. They're not achieving anything. But you go over and you give them a hug, or you go over and you give them a nice compliment, or you're attuned to them. Like, if there is a foundation of love that's based on things outside of achievement first, then the pushing a kid and trying to have healthy expectations for them, there's nothing damaging about that. That is more exclusively healthy. It's when we end up only really giving love, and you can think of so many, different experiences of where this occurs. But maybe you have a family where they're kind of strict, sort of stiff upper lip type of culture, and they're not very loving to their kids. They're not very attuned to them. And then the only time the kids get love or approval is when they achieve. And yeah, then you're going to create a set of conditions where the conditioning of that child is such that they try to achieve as a means of gaining love in the world. And they're probably going to be hyperachievers, maybe at the expense of considering themselves. Maybe they'll work themselves into the ground and drive themselves crazy, just trying to earn love. Like, you can see contexts like that. But if there is a household where parents are loving far outside of that, and then there's that push there, there's nothing that's going to be, screwing anybody up or anything of that nature. And I think it's important to note those things. To sort of take that a layer deeper, when you look at some of these themes, you said, like, okay, it's impossible not to screw a child up. Parents, I would make a good distinction between every parent's going to make mistakes. Nobody's ever going to have all the answers. Nobody should even try to have all the answers. That includes securely attached parents who aren't bringing in their attachment issues and challenges. Nobody's going to be perfect. But where we get trauma and where we get impact is when you're looking at ratios of repetition and emotion. So repetition and emotion is what fires and wires neural networks and really creates patterning in people over time. So if you have, I was saying to my friend the other day, she's like literally the best person. She's two young kids. She's like an amazing mom. She tries so hard. She's so loving. And she's like, "Oh my gosh, I got so angry at my kid the other day. I yelled at them. And did I, are they going to have attachment issues?" And I was like, "Look, you probably hurt their feelings. But, your ratio of how much you're not the parent that yells, at how much you're the person that communicates and honors their needs and talks things out and holds space and are attuned is so far skewed in the direction of that." And there's so little of this, like, it's not this constant theme of always yelling. So yeah, you hurt their feelings. You're not screwing anybody up. You're not, And so it's really about the ratio of behaviors and how that's conditioning over time that then is so much of what's going to create that patterns. And so those sets of patterns. And so that's what you want to be looking for. It's like, what is my parenting style rooted in? What are the ratio of things? If I'm like 50-50 attuned and angry, yeah, there's going to be some stuff that's there. But if it's like 90% of the time you're showing up really well and 10% you're a human, you forget things, or you raise your voice, or you kind of made a sharp comment or things like that, you're a human, and kids are going to have that experience in school. They're going to have that experience with other people in the workplace and strangers. So that shouldn't be so foreign to them. It's okay to have a little bit of challenge sometimes. And I think that's really important to know.
Yeah, for sure. And parenting is just inherently really hard. Like, we don't learn this. Like, it's not in the structure of society or culture to, like, be good at these things. And I feel like a lot of people hold resentment because of the way their parents showed up during their childhood. But, like, everybody does the best they can with the tools they have at the time. And, they weren't, especially, like, the older generations might not have been resourced as the new ones are with more education, like your YouTube channel. But also, it's like a source of compassion, because you can look at your parents through that lens of, like, oh, I get it. Like, when they were young, this, that, and the other, and then they develop these patterns to help them survive. And, like, I get why they raised me the way they did. And it could be used as a lens to really foster more connection with your parents and replace some of that resentment. It could just make the world a more compassionate place. Like my wife also mentioned something to me years ago where it's like when you see somebody that is maybe acting out or behaving in a way that you think is, you know, inappropriate, illegal, hurtful, whatever the thing is, it's like just asking, like, I wonder what happened to them.
Yeah.
Like that question. It's like, yeah, we all have all these, we have these attachment styles, which is just like a way to humanize, to like compartmentalize, to create like a scaffolding to how to view the different behaviors that we have in relation to ourselves or others. And it's like, that's really useful to like have that scaffolding, but it's like all, you know, everybody was zero, like what you said, this all happened between zero to, well, everybody was zero to two at some point, you know. It's like they were, so like that's really helpful to like give you perspective over like where somebody else is or where they're coming from. It's funny, when I think about like my parents, there's such a, I don't know what the word is, like bifurcation. I don't know if I've ever used that word. I'm probably using the wrong word. I don't know. But like the difference between one parent and the other was so vast. Like I felt one parent, even though there were skills she probably wasn't good at, like my mother had unconditional love all the time. Like I never went a minute in my life not feeling wholeheartedly that I was loved. I could do no wrong in her arms. It may be to a fault. You know, it may be I would have gotten like less trouble as a kid if she didn't like love me so much no matter what or whatever. But then my father was, you know, loved in his own way and had a, I think, a lot of unresolved stuff for himself that showed up, and he was drinking, which I know like disengaged him, and I get why he did that and why it helped him. But like there were times where I would need him to come towards me, like when I would get in trouble, like I don't know if it was a cry for help, but like I wanted, you know, he had already left. And, you know, that was a two-party thing. Like, I think my mom kind of nudged him out a little bit. But it's like every time I got in trouble, I always felt like I wanted him to come towards me. But he would always show up as like, I'm too mad to talk to you. So he would do the opposite. So it's like this total, like two complete opposite ends of the spectrum of how to show up. And maybe that's good. Like maybe I got the benefit of like seeing two sides of a coin and being able to learn from that and choosing like, how do I want to approach my kids, which I do think I've done. Like when my kids get in trouble, I want to be the first one in line to give them a hug and be like, there's nothing you can do, no activity, no behavior that could penetrate like my love for you. Like, and I want to be able to show them that. So like there's benefits, but also if there's such a vast spectrum of potential styles that parents show up with and near infinite combination, essentially, like that really throws a wrench in it for someone when you're influenced by not one person, but to two people, and those two people can handle things so differently. And I guess in an ideal world, you just kind of scoop up or absorb like the positive of each of those, like the superpower. Like that, I'm sure that's not the way it goes.
Well, I think there's a couple of things, and I love that you said all of that. I think that, you know, so much, it's funny because you said your wife says, oh, like, what do they go through? I always say, like, what's the sponsoring intention? Like, when that person, like, raised their voice, what's the sponsoring intention? Oh, they felt deeply unheard, and they were, it was a desperate attempt to try to get louder so that you could hear them. You know, you see these dynamics of what's really happening beneath the surface a lot of the time, and it's so interesting. But I was reading something this morning, and somebody said something like, oh, it was about their parents. I said, my parents make me feel angry. And, you know, I was thinking like, that should be course corrected to, I feel angry at my parents. Because nobody, you know, is still all this time later making you feel angry. You're carrying anger, right? And things within you, ways you're perceiving things, things that you're holding on to, wounds that you have, are things that you're still feeling on a daily basis. And, you know, I think that we have a duty to ourselves, literally to ourselves, not to anybody else, but to us, to work through those things You know, I always say to people, it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility. Right. Like, you know, you didn't ask for a lot of the patterns you might have been conditioned with if they were hard. But, you know, only you can heal them, especially as an adult. And so a lot of people had not perfect childhoods, you know, a lot of people. And you know, we're not alone. And in that, if you're listening to this thinking like, oh my gosh, it's me, there's the millions of people who are like that. But I found frequently that what's unresolved in our relationships as children with parents show up in our romantic relationships as adults. So I think that we have a duty to our romantic relationships to resolve those things. I have found that when we're holding things deeply and we're not forgiving things, they get projected everywhere, especially in the relationship to ourselves. And the things that we are still carrying resentment or frustration around the most are things we are still actively doing in the relationship to ourselves too. So I had a client once and she said, oh gosh, my mom's so critical. I have to go visit her this weekend. I just hate spending the weekend with her because she just criticizes me all weekend. And I had met her for like two sessions. I was just getting to know her still. And I said, okay, and from 1 to 10, how critical are you of yourself? And I remember she just like went white. Like it was like the color went out of her. And she was like, oh my God, I am my mother to myself. And I was like, yeah, no wonder. And it's funny because as she worked on rewiring a lot of her internal dialogue, a lot of that self-criticism, she was able to turn around and actually feel like she took her mother's criticism a lot less personally and then could see it for what it was. Oh, my mom was wired this way herself and she had a lot of criticism from her mother. And, you know, and she could see it and not take it on, you know, not take it to heart so much. And it actually improved the relationship with her mother and she could set boundaries around it. And she didn't leave the weekend being like, I am all the things my mother said. She left the weekend being like, oh, my mom is projecting her stuff, you know? And so I think we have a duty to ourselves to be able to work through it as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm sure there's that story probably is echoed in so many different variations, you know. So you mentioned rewiring. So what do you do? So you have a ton of content I already alluded to, but how do you help people? Like, what are the services that you're offering? How do you do this stuff?
Yeah, so my background is in everything from hypnotherapy to neuroscience to neurolinguistic. A lot of my, so I have a PhD in pastoral counseling and then sort of love to overlap like ancient wisdom with modern day psychology and neuroscience. Like I got really into those two things and finding where they overlap. And a lot of my early practice with people was working with people on literally rewiring their core wounds, learning to meet their needs, learning to regulate their nervous system so they're not in sympathetic nervous system all the time. And what was interesting is when I revisited attachment styles and relationships, because a lot of people just come in for relationship stuff all the time when I was running my practice. I was like, oh, if I know somebody's attachment style, I know what their core wounds are or their triggers, you know, abandonment or being trapped or, you know, I know what their needs are going to be, you know, at least strongly direction. We're going to know the landscape of this, what you can then tell them. And it improves their quality of being able to self-soothe, but also improve their relationship. I know they're going to have nervous system dysregulation when they're insecurely attached. And I know the types of boundaries they're going to have, communication patterns they're going to have, and behavioral coping mechanisms that they'll have. You know, dismissive avoidance are more creature comfort people, right? They self-soothe through that. Anxious attachment styles are self-silencers and people pleasers. So, you know, I knew all this stuff about all these people, but so much of my background was just working on actually rewiring these things for people. And, you know, I started my career as a hypnotherapist, like starting with a lot of hypnotherapy techniques, and I never really liked it. I was like, oh, I feel like it's a little strange. Like it's like give the man a fish instead of teach a man to fish. And so instead I was like, let's just leverage techniques from hypnotherapy and neuroscience and where they blend and help people rewire their own stuff without having to do hypnotherapy. And there's some really powerful tools people can use that create huge impacts and they're not hard. People hear neuroscience or hypnotherapy and they think, oh my gosh, it's not hard. And there's quite a few of them, but I really help people first understand their attachment style, then understand the roadmap of those six pillars, you know, what their core wounds are going to be, what their needs are going to be, what their nervous system themes are going to be like, et cetera, you know, the boundaries, communication, behaviors, and then find what's maladaptive and then dig into leveraging our techniques to actually rewire what's maladaptive so that they sort of like we were talking about earlier, they keep their superpowers and their personality, but the things that are hurting them, the things that are not working well for them that they want to outgrow and leave behind, they actually can. And so that's how we're really taking responsibility for what maybe has affected us in our childhood and finally leaving it in the past where it belongs, because otherwise our subconscious mind stores and carries everything and we'll keep carrying it forth in our lives in different ways. And it's not fun to do. So being able to actually change it is so valuable. And at this point, You know, we've helped about 40,000 people through our programs and have a 99.7% NPS score, like satisfaction score from the people coming through the programs. And so, yeah.
Logistically, what is it? This is one-on-one? Is this group? Like,
through group coaching programs. So basically they're self-paced. We have content. So it's video courses that are all there that give you like the roadmap of your attachment style and all the details and your personal sort of blueprint in all those areas. And then we have courses for each of those six pillars. They're not even very long. They're you know, 2 hours each or so. And after you get your blueprint, you actually go into, okay, let's start with the core wounds. Let's learn how to rewire your triggers so you're not constantly fearing abandonment or betrayal or being trapped or these things that constantly pop up in our relationships. And there's, you know, three usually tools per pillar, per course.
What's an example of a tool? Like what modality are you using? You say you're no longer using hypnotherapy. What are you using?
Okay, so I'll give an example. And it's a little long, but I'll give it to you in a short version. So one really easy example, it's a good sort of starter kit tool, is we have a tool called auto-suggestion, so a form of belief reprogramming. So when we have, you know, we come into the world, we don't have all of our beliefs that get conditioned into us, and we can recondition them. So what, let's say somebody has a core wound, I'm not good enough. People say things like, oh, do affirmations, but affirmations are kind of BS. Like affirmations don't, you know, really work that well. I don't know if you love affirmations or something, but you know, a lot of people out in the world are like affirmations. Affirmations, the reason they don't work very well is that your conscious mind speaks language and your subconscious speaks in emotions and images. So your conscious mind, if I say to you, whatever you do, do not think of a pink elephant. You probably thought of a pink elephant or flashed a little image of a pink elephant in your mind. And your conscious mind hears do not because it speaks language, but your subconscious speaks in emotions and imagery. So when we're trying to fire and wire new neural pathways, it's important to know that neural pathways atrophy like muscles. If you don't work them out, if you don't work out your biceps, they go away. They shrink. Same thing with neural pathways in the brain. So if we were to actually dive in and try to rewire a limiting belief, like I'm not good enough, or a trigger, a wound we've been carrying, first thing we do is we find the opposite. I am good enough, right? We want to install a new belief. Second thing we do is we have to speak in emotion and imagery repeatedly to our subconscious mind so that it fires and wires these new neural pathways. And because emotions and images are the language of the subconscious mind. So how we do this is we find old memory, because all memory is a container for emotions and images. If I say, tell me your favorite childhood memory, and you were to say, oh, it's playing at the beach with my family and my friends, you'd see the images of the sand and the waves and maybe your family and the umbrella, and you'd see the images in your mind. And when you tell old memories, we've all seen it, people smile. Or their body language changes. If it's a sad memory, they shrink and they become sad. If it's a happy memory, they smile, they open, they laugh. So when we bring up old memory, it actually helps us elicit emotions and images. So here are three steps to rewire. And this is just like a starter kit one. Number one, what's your belief you're trying to rewire? I'm not good enough. The opposite is I am good enough. Number two, we need repetition of emotion and imagery. So we need 10 old memories of when we actually did feel good enough. And if we're willing to look, we'll be able to find them. They do not have to be big. They can be things like, you know, I worked really hard as a friend, you know, last week and really showed up, or I worked really hard to overcome this challenge at work. And, you know, they can be little tiny things, everyday experiences. But when we think of them, they elicit a little feeling and we see the little images in our mind of what we did. And so we note those things down. We come up with 10 of them. Then we record them, step three. And we listen back for 21 days. And ideally, we listen back in a suggestible state. So when our brain's producing more alpha brainwaves, so when we first wake up, the first hour, the last hour before we go to bed, after a meditation, after a heavy-duty workout, you know, our brain's producing more alpha brainwaves in those cases. And so our mind is more suggestible. Our subconscious sponges up more information. So we have, I am good enough. Here's the 10 pieces of evidence or memory I have that I am actually good enough, little tiny things. Our job when we're focusing on listening back to what we've recorded down for the 21 days is to really feel it in our body and see it in our mind's eye. So to try to be present with it. And once we record it into our phone and listen back to us saying these things out loud and visualizing them, you know, it only takes like 3 or 4 minutes a day, and it's profoundly impactful. It really works for people. And people can spend decades carrying these wild wounds that hurt, you know, the fears of abandonment, the fears of being not good enough or unworthy, or the belief that you're always going to be trapped in a relationship. And by rewiring it for 21 days, research shows it takes about 21 days to really create neural pathways that are strong enough to stick as the other ones are atrophying. We can let go of these parts of our really relationship baggage that we've been carrying for decades.
So you're convincing yourself you're good enough by hearing your own voice talk about the things that are the evidence. So you have the like chemical makeup of this going on while you're thinking about it, like the chemical makeup of whatever the emotion was linked to that experience that you remembered, and you just
exactly go through the list. Exactly. That's, and it's getting to your subconscious mind because it's speaking in the subconscious mind's language, and the wound is not conscious. Nobody's waking up and saying, I'm going to tell myself I'm not good enough 30 times today, right, and see how I feel. So yeah, we're getting to the subconscious. And, you know, maybe rather than convincing, I would say it like you're noticing, you know, because I think what happens is we have these like ideas that, oh, I'm just not good enough as a human being. And like, no way. Everybody has strengths. Everybody has places they show up. And when we strengthen the belief in ourselves, because we do notice these things, we take inventory, we see about them, we visualize them, we feel about them in our bodies, so they actually stick in our subconscious mind. When we do that work, what's really interesting is people will be like, oh, I didn't realize that I had these skills over here. And they start to see themselves differently. And the more we actually believe that we are good enough, the more we take actions, you know, the more confidence we have, the more we show up for things and challenge ourselves. And so it kind of has this, you know, knock-on effect where it ripples out, because when we believe good things about ourselves, then we feel better. And then we continue to find improvement.
For sure. Well, that's great. Well, looking at the clock now, Thais, I've really enjoyed this, and there's a lot I did not get to. And you alluded to a couple of things. Maybe we'll have to have you back on sometime, but you mentioned the love languages, the pillars. So maybe another day we'll dive into those. But I thought this was just a fantastic summary of these attachment styles. And I'm going to try not to go crazy and analyze everybody in my life. But it's interesting just hearing about them, how, like, you know, the people close to you just like pop in your mind and you start seeing, you know, through the lens. So I do think it's a fascinating topic, and I think there's probably just a ton of value to come from learning more about yourself through the lens of these, and then making little shifts, and whether it's just the way you think about things or more like dramatic processes, like you just mentioned about rewiring, you know, I'm sure it's going to make life better. It's going to make life better.
Definitely.
So I want to thank you for taking the time and giving us this little education here and, you know, helping me out. Like I pointed out some things, and thanks for making space for me to share a little bit and feel safe enough to be vulnerable for doing that. And I find that sometimes that is my medicine. And sometimes I use this podcast as like, I don't know, a journal or something where I could just get things from the inside to the outside, and it could help me create a little pivot and shift gears a little bit in my own life. So I appreciate you being there for that.
Love that. I think that's such a great thing to do. Why not use the podcast as a learning experience all the time in so many ways? So I love that. I really enjoyed that part of the podcast too. So thanks for sharing. And thank you so much for having me on. This was so much fun.
Sure. How do people find you if they want more?
So I'm at personaldevelopmentschool.com. That's where we have those self-paced courses. And then we do a group coaching call every day with either myself, or we actually have two of them a day. So for all different time zones. Yeah, twice a day. I'm only there 3 days a week, but I have other counselors and coaches and people in there that work with us, who are colleagues of mine. So that's there. And then I'm on YouTube, which is Personal Development School Thais Gibson, Thais. And then Instagram, which is at The Personal Development School.
Awesome. Well, for the listeners, always grateful for your listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Thais, thanks again. I look forward to our paths crossing again sometime.
Thank you so much, Lasse. It was great to be here with you.
Have a good day, everybody.